Anytime a book comes out by Ken Dryden, you should pay attention. The Game was one of the great books ever written by a sports or otherwise, by anyone in this country, or in any country for that matter. And as a result of that and the topic at hand, this Ken Dryden book is a must read. It's called Game Change, The Life and Death of Steve Montador and the Future of Hockey. The author, the former goaltender, the former president of the Maple Leaf Sports and Entertainment, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, Ken Dryden in studio. Lovely to see you. How are you?
Good to see you, Bob. And did your house burn down last week?
No, it did not. But it came. We came close. Fire trucks 2 days in a row. Oh yeah, you called me the day that was all going on. Right?
Was he just keeping an eye on you?
No, he called me while I was in the garage, and there were firemen all over my house. Trying to figure out what was going on.
Did he offer to come over and help?
Or? He didn't, actually.
No, he didn't.
No, didn't, actually.
He may have said it.
I'm always intrigued by the motivation to write a book, and I don't think you write just for the sake of writing. I think you have to be motivated to write. You have to feel something about it and think that the story is important, and I assume you think this story is important. Now, the truth of the matter is, you probably could have picked any one of a number of subjects to write about. Why Montador?
Well, that's a very good question. Mostly it was the timing of it, because I felt like it was the time to write a book about concussions and sports. And I heard on the radio, as others did, of Steve Montador's death. And so then I just followed up on that. But I knew that if ever we were going to get closer to the concussion story, it had to be through a person. You had to write a person's, you know, a life story, because that's what it's about. It's a life and how a life is affected. And as it turned out, I knew I didn't want to write about a star's experience, because it would end up being more about the star than it would be about, you know, the question. I didn't really appreciate it until kind of being in the middle of it, that Steve was a pretty much of an everyman player. I mean, that he played over 500 games. He played any role that he was asked to play. He loved to be around a team. He was understood as a great teammate. And he kind of jumped both feet into the experience. But it was more coincidental that it was Steve, but I knew it needed to be about a person.
I don't know exactly how to ask this question, but one of the things that surprised me about the book is that I expected you to tell us why the game needed to change, why the concussion issue was important. It's not that you don't, but you did it through the life of Montador and not as much about your own perspective and opinion on it, at least not until the last couple of chapters. Deliberate?
Yeah, well, it was. I mean, the parts of the book that grew is that I knew, you know, again, the structure would be around a person. But then as I got into it, I realized I needed to write more and more and more about the game itself, because unless you have the context of a game, then all of the kind of counter arguments to, well, you can't change anything because the game's the game and you can't mess around with the game. Well, if you're really a purist and a traditionalist, as you like to, you know, one's, you know, says they are, and you can't change the game, let's just go back to this game. This game has changed unbelievably over its history since 1875, that it was a no-substitution game first. For the first 50 years, there was no forward passing. In the 1950s, when I started watching games, and I didn't realize it until I watched full game action many years later, how slow the game was, how long the shifts were, and everything followed from the slowness of the action. And then you get into today's game, where it's a sprint. I mean, it's like, you know, a 4x100 meter relay. You're just passing the baton every 35 seconds, right? And you do that the whole game, and that changes a game. you know, in lots of different ways, mostly in tremendously exciting ways. And we're watching that happen now, that in fact, the skills of the players have caught up with the possibilities of the game. I mean, that it used to be you move faster, but you move too fast for the skills to present themselves. Now the skills are at the service of the speed, and when you get the two of them together, it's quite unbelievable, as you know, what is happening. But it means there are more collisions, more forceful collisions, because players are moving faster all of the time.
See, and I was interested because, of course, your book, as Bob mentioned at the top, was The Game. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you had that in mind when this one was called Game Change, but it could imply a couple of things, that the game has changed or that the game must change.
Yeah.
What did you have in mind?
Well, that's exactly what I mean. That I didn't have either in mind when I thought of, you know, the about Game Change, but then it was exactly as you said. It was that the game has changed, and that the game needs to change mm-hmm. as well. But yes, no, that was exactly it. And the challenge of it, you know, was that, of course, there was a very popular political book called Game Change. Mm. And so the first were, you know, message back from the publishers, well, you can't use the same name. Mm. But then I said, well, wait a second. This is exactly what this book is about. The other book was kind of using sports words in order to describe political change, but that this really was the appropriate title for
it. So in your mind then, was Montador as the focal point, the central character of your story, was he a player caught in the middle of change, and that's kind of what happened to him? Or is he an example of why the game has to change?
Yeah, I think it's more that Steve played the game that you know was there to play, and evolving, you know, towards you know, greater speed and the implications of speed.
Okay.
And the thing that you know that he wasn't an exaggerated player. He wasn't the kind of player that you'd say, well, he was a goon, and so therefore, you know, these things happen to goons. Or he was so completely reckless that I'm not surprised that this happened. I mean, yeah, he had his moments of recklessness. Yeah, he got into his fights, but he was essentially a player not too much different from a lot of other players. And so if this could happen to him out of kind of natural, normal play, then that's when you start to worry, as opposed to when you've got the, you know, the special example. I mean, I think it's why when Sidney Crosby got his concussions, that not only was it Crosby and the greatest player in the game and the rest of it, but that he played in such a normal way. I mean, he played the way that Canadian, the prototypical Canadian played, if you could play as well as he did. I mean, he went into the corners, he went to the front of the net, he forced his way, it was physical without being punishing. It was, you know, it was the game that was in your mind as that you wanted everybody to play, and here was a guy who was having concussion problems.
I always think of a comparative of Eric Lindros to mm-hmm. To Sidney Crosby in trying to analyze, and I think the two of them played had a similar mindset when they played the game. They weren't afraid to be tough. They weren't afraid to hit. But their real acknowledgement was their creativity, their ability to score, their ability to pass, their ability to put points on the board. Montador was not that guy. He was an everyman's player. He was just a guy.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Does that influence, or did it wind up influencing how you told this story?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I just wanted, you know, that whatever Steve's story was his story. But you know, that what I knew, of course, is that in writing this, it couldn't be about awareness. You know, that we have all dealt with awareness. We all know the strength of awareness, and we know the limitations of awareness. That we think that if in fact we make others aware of a problem, then those who are the decision makers will take that awareness and implement that awareness with, you know, and with actions. And, you know, it almost in a perfunctory way. I mean, automatically we're aware, therefore we do. No, I mean, that's almost never the case, whether it's in sports or in climate change or inequality or whatever it is. There's a huge gap between awareness and actually making the decisions to change things. So this book had to be, kind of the story that led up to, okay, now we are where we are. We understand the stakes in terms of the player and the impact on a player's person's life. We understand the science and what science can do, but what science can't do, what science doesn't know, what science won't know tomorrow, because that's the way science works. And we know the nature of a game and how it has changed. And so, okay, now we get to hear what then, you know, are the decisions that need to be made that are consistent with the dimensions of the problem.
We believe the National Football League is resistant to change and resistant to acknowledging the reality of CTE.
Right.
We believe that the NHL is equally resistant to change and equally resistant to the notion that the game causes CTE. Do you believe that?
I think that football is, I mean, if I was Roger Goodell, I don't know what the heck I would do, except kind of manage, dance, and pretend. And which I wouldn't be very happy about doing in it. Because I'm not sure how you end up reducing the head contact sufficiently to make really much difference.
In a game like football where contact is instrumental in the game.
It is, and it's virtually every play it's going to
happen. No, it is every play. It's every single play. Yeah. You almost cannot play the game.
That's right.
Without it.
That's right.
Hockey is different. Right.
And that's why, like, when I approached this, it was like hockey has answers. That's the really good part of all of this. And that it's my job in writing this to try to, one, convey the dimensions of the problem, But at the same time saying, you know, that isn't enough. You have to offer a pathway out. You've watched decision makers. I've watched decision makers. You put a decision maker into the corner. What do? They fight back even harder. You've got to, if somebody is in a corner, you've got to offer them a way out. What is the way out of this corner? And hockey has ways out of the corner. That's the purpose of the book. I didn't want any more awareness. Awareness is just, you know, me or others deciding that we're right about something and isn't it wonderful and nothing happens and who cares about being right and nothing happening.
The book is Game Change. Ken Dryden is the author. He's in studio. Damien.
Yeah, at the end of a conclusion of a book like this, I mean, it's almost like prosecuting a case and you're left at the end where you wonder how you should feel about the person in this case. And I wonder how the reader should feel and how you end up feeling about Steve Montador. Should we feel sorry for him? Should we feel he was the architect of his own fate? Or should we feel that someone or something or some organization is to blame for what happened to him?
Well, I think it's some of those things. But my focus is much less any of those, because I think that if you end up sort of fighting old fights, you get nowhere. I mean, you get, you know.
So what do you mean?
Well, like, meaning in terms of, you know, that this guy's fault because he didn't do this, okay, and that guy's fault because he didn't do that. And so essentially, okay, you know, the courts or somebody else will decide that. That's the way it is. The key question is, now what? That is the, you know, the essence of any of this. What I would hope that a reader would come out of it, you know, with is that, you know, they feel about Steve however they feel about Steve. What I would hope is that they would feel as if, and was a line that I used towards the end, that what happened to him was not fair, not right, and not necessary. And the critical words are the last two, in a way. It's the not right. Necessary, that lots of things are not right and not fair, and we don't know what to do about them, and we can't do anything about them, and we get on with things. It's when you get to the not necessary, that's when the action is possible. And that's what all of this, you know, is about. I think, again, there are the answers in hockey. And I think Gary Bettman, you know, is one, he is the commissioner and he's going to be the commissioner. But two, I think a number of things. One, he's smart. Two, he's absolutely capable. Three, he is experienced. And four, he really has greater authority within hockey than certainly any of the other commissioners have in the other main sports. And that doesn't come from job description entirely. It mostly comes from 24 years working through things and mostly winning the salary cap in 2005. And since that time, he has been by far the most influential person in hockey, and not, you know, Don Fear, not Rene Fasel, not the head of Hockey Canada or anybody else. It really is Gary Bettman. And he is capable personally and in a professional position to be able to implement the kinds of changes that can be made and need to be made.
But in the book, you categorize Mr. Bettman with regard to his response to the CTE issue as, quote, restrained concern, unquote.
Yeah. That was what his letter was. I mean, his letter in response to Blumenthal was that. Now, you know, that is a component of part of the arsenal of anybody in a position of authority and of a commissioner, that you're fighting the politics of it at that moment. You're also fighting in the courts, and you put on your lawyer's hat and you fight to win that case. What I am saying is that there is a third hat to wear. And there's a third hat that he can wear, and a third hat that he is capable of wearing, and that given the nature of the problem in hockey, that it is something, it is a problem you don't need to run away from. You can run towards. And football is a different story. This one you can run towards.
Yeah, well, football, as you said, and I think we all agree, there doesn't seem to be an end game to it.
No matter
what you do.
That's right.
The only conclusion you can come to is don't play football.
Right. That's right.
The dramatic changes that would need to happen to the rules would be such that the game would be unrecognizable.
That's right.
But not true in hockey.
Not true in hockey. And the thing is that, you know, and maybe we just talked about it, but of every game that you see on television now is more indication of how hockey can be played, the possibilities of hockey. I mean, it's like, I made reference in an article that I wrote to watching the first game of the season again with the Leafs and the Jets. The first 10 minutes were amazing. I mean, they were flying, handling the puck as if they owned it, making unbelievable passes. I mean, that this is a game now that is getting more and more exciting. And I made a point as well at a certain point, and said, okay, let's see how many really head hits and dangerous head hits are happening in this game. And I'm watching it and watching it and watching it. There are virtually none in the course of the game. Now, did I miss it because of, I mean, it was this unbelievable action that was taking place. If this was 10 or 15 years ago, the players wouldn't have had the skill to replace the absence of the, you know, of the really exaggerated physical stuff to be as interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Now this game is absolutely, you know, compellingly interesting, and in this particular way.
So not only has the style of game changed, basically all players wear visors now. Yeah. Once we thought that couldn't be done,
that's right,
but it did happen. There's fighting, I think, in one out of every four games.
Right.
So it does change. But why are we not where we need to be then on the issue of concussions and I guess head trauma, whatever?
Because we still have those hits. We still have those hits to the head, and even if most of the great majority of them do not happen in fights, they happen in the incidental action of it. You don't even need a goony guy out there for it to happen now, because you're moving fast enough, and you are having more collisions, that happen. And the players are a little bit bigger, so that increases the force. But mostly it's the speed, of it. And
some say it's too fast, and that's creating problems.
Yeah, but I think those can be manageable problems. I mean, I would really, you know, resist the, you know, to try to shut it down, you know, in that way. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the things I talk about in the book is sort of is finishing your check, you know, in it, you know, and of how we tried to slow, we tried to protect players with interference, you know, because we knew they were vulnerable. Then we decided to get rid of, you know, the, of that, which made them, you know, wide open to be hit. But, you know, with, if you eliminate the finishing your check, what you're doing is you're forcing the player to be responsible for his own speed. You're not asking the defense partner to commit interference so that you're protected. You offer the protection because you're saying to the guy, if you arrive in time, fine. If you don't, then the consequences are up to you in it. So have it self-controlled. Have it self-policing. You know, that if the speed is reduced in any way, it's reduced of your own volition, as opposed to kind of the artificial things that stand in the
way. But don't you
think
that's happening? Like, I was watching, just for one example, because I was thinking about your book last night, that Toronto-Detroit game, and they're not the two most physical teams in the league, but I was sort of started cataloging as the game went on the number of time players pulled up and didn't make a hit that certainly when you played and even 15, 20 years ago, they would have made that hit.
Five years ago, maybe.
Yeah, yeah. Right. That there is some kind of self-regulation going on.
There is, and all of that's terrific. But we still have lots of concussions. I mean, that, you know, that is also the fact of it. The thing that, again, all of these things that we're pointing out, the skills of a game, you know, the self-police. I mean, part of why they're pulling up is not because they don't want to deliver the hit. It's that it's they want to keep in motion because it's a keep in motion game. So that's great. I mean, you know, that this and so it becomes natural, you know, to it. All of that is quite terrific. And what it means is that you know, that next step of saying no hits to the head, no excuses, is much less of a leap than it would have been 5 years ago or 10 years ago. I mean, the game, you know, is ready for that to happen.
So why isn't it happening?
It hasn't happened yet. But it has
happened in the Ontario Hockey League and international hockey. They are much stronger at times against.
Well, I don't know. One of the things that I found, and this is somewhat separate from, I was in Vancouver and talking to somebody who's doing a documentary on junior hockey and fighting.
I know. There's more fighting.
And what was interesting as I was talking with them is, like, in the NHL, and I was talking to, you know, a very famous former coach, and he was saying, you almost can't match lines anymore. Because if you're only on for 35 seconds, all you need is a 10-second mismatch of the fourth line and the first line, and you're in trouble. The only thing you can do a little bit is match a defense pair with a line. So it means that the fourth line, that used to be the one high-energy guy, one goon, and something else, you can't afford that anymore. Yeah. So it's the nature of the game that is eliminating the fighter, you know, in that particular way. Well, the problem in junior hockey is that they don't have the same depth. And it's like they didn't get the memo that says that you're supposed to be preparing guys for the NHL. Guess what? The NHL is changing in that way, and so you're the last bastion almost of kind of premeditated and strategic fighting. You can't do it in minor hockey. In the NHL, because of, you know, the implications or the consequences, the on ice complication. And then you get to junior hockey. So I don't know. I haven't seen junior hockey very much.
Yeah, that they still have so much.
I got a question. I mean, it just has popped into my head. 10 years ago, approximately, every team in the NHL had one, and most teams had two goons. Would you acknowledge, Damien?
Well, they all had at least one.
At least one. And many had two.
And some had three.
Okay. How many do they have now?
Most teams still have somebody, but some teams have nobody.
And that player who is their toughest guy probably can play where many of the guys who were goons before really had no other value.
Could not play.
Really had no other value. How did that happen?
Well, it's the shortage.
Was it a mandate from the league?
No, I don't think. Well, I don't think so. I think it's the shortage. It's the shorter shifts, and the increased speed of a game, and where suddenly these guys on the fourth line couldn't keep up anymore, and you couldn't keep them away. You couldn't play fourth line against fourth line. You couldn't depend on that anymore. And all of a sudden, you're vulnerable because they're out against the better players.
All right, so let me. I'll take that with apologies with a grain of salt. Maybe that's the answer. So here's another thing that coincidentally has happened. Same thing 10 years ago. Who gets drafted by junior teams? Who gets drafted by NHL teams? Size, speed. 6'2", 6'4", 6'6". If you're big and strong, we'll draft you. If you're 5'10", filled with skill, scored 150 goals in midget hockey, you couldn't even get a sniff in the junior, much less to the NHL. Now, those guys are back.
That's right. They are back, and I mean, you can be big, but you can't be just big. You know, you've got to be big and talented.
Yeah.
And one of the things that's, you know, it's a big change in the last number of years is the belief in development. I mean, at one time, you better pretty much arrive developed. And yeah, we'll throw you on the ice in the minor leagues for a year or two and see what happens. But now it really is, you know, you can develop these guys and you've got all of these trainers, and because you can afford them and there's no salary cap on coaches and trainers and all the rest of it. So all of that, you know, has changed significantly. And I think what's happening, and you may know better, but it seems as if the NHL teams, after the third round or so, you're drafting guys that you think might be and hope would be third and fourth line players.
Sure.
I don't think you're doing that anymore.
Yeah.
I think that they think that they can develop a third or fourth line player over time, and that they're taking flyers on guys who they think have the talent to be special, even if most of them wash out, you know, in the third round, fourth round, fifth round, eighth round, and you sign as free agents the guys who you think, you know, will put in 3 or 4 years develop.
The late bloomers, as we used to call them.
That's
know, we're
That's
drafting kids at 18 years old. Not everybody is ready to go at 18 years old.
That's right.
Some kids get a lot better when they're 19 and a lot better when they're 20.
That's right.
The issue,
one more.
Yeah, the issue of concussions often leads to the issue of fighting. And I wonder, I mean, it is an inherent contradiction to try to reduce headshots and head contact in the National Hockey League, but allow... Right. Well, penalized, but basically to allow bare knuckle fighting.
That's right.
Can the two ever exist?
I think that
can you reduce headshots, concussions, while allowing fighting to be part of it?
I mean, I think it's like what we were talking about of how the fourth line, you know, changes because the game changes. I think that what the issue here is. I mean, I never liked the fighting part of it because I thought it was just kind of stupid. But, you know, a lot of people didn't agree with that, and that's the way it was. I think that the real issue here, and the question is, it isn't about fighting or not fighting. It is about brain injuries. That's what it's about. And you can, you know, go on with the argument of, well, I like fighting and we need a release and we need all of that. No, that's not what it's about. We know the impact of brain injuries. It's not nice. It's not a nice life afterwards. That, you know, those are the consequences of it. And so the blow to the head, whether it is by a shoulder, an elbow, a stick, or a fist, it's a blow to the head. The brain does not distinguish one from another. One isn't, you know, it's a fist, no big deal, it's allowed. Sorry, the brain doesn't react that way. So it becomes about that. And that is where the debate is, I think, or it should be.
We could talk all day, but time is our enemy. The book is called Game Change, The Life and Death of Steve Montador and the Future of Hockey. And the author is Ken Dryden. It's great to see you as always. Thank you for the book,
Bob.
And we'll see you again soon, I hope.
Thank you.